You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 27th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Mika Utrich on his book, Strike for America, Teachers versus Austerity, on the Chicago Teachers Against Austerity. Also on the program today, Northwestern football players in a somewhat unexpected ruling by the National Labor Relations Board may seek to form a union. Going to have huge implications down the road for college sports. Also on the program today, President Obama explaining how the Iraq invasion and occupation was so much better than the Russian invasion of Crimea. And in New York City, Lex Luthor was tried in a federal court and did not use his X-ray vision or his laser vision to burn down the building. Actually, it wasn't Lex Luthor. Lex Luthor was a spokesperson. It was Suleiman Abgut. Osama bin Laden's close confidant and son-in-law, tried in federal court, proving that you can try people on terrorism charges in a federal court in New York. And it's not apocalyptic. And meanwhile, BP, new data on what their oil spill in the Gulf did to fish in the Gulf. Apparently, they just wanted to also try it out and see if it works with freshwater, too. So they went ahead and spilled some oil in Lake Michigan. We will get to that. Yes, Michael put it nicely. I guess we can say a-holes on Thursday. First off, some good news. In Connecticut, our neighboring state here in New York, the State House, the General Assembly, and the State Senate, and I should say, in all disclosure, I worked in the Connecticut State Senate for a year, almost 26 years ago. So I don't think I had any impact on this vote. The passed a bill, 21-14 in the Senate, 87-54 in the House, to raise the minimum wage from $8.70 to $10.10 by January of 2017. The Connecticut Governor, Daniel Malloy, is expected to sign the bill tonight at Cafe Beauregard, the New Britain restaurant where President Obama dined before a minimum wage rally 3 weeks ago. At $10.10, they would be the highest minimum wage state in the country. Washington state has a $9.32 minimum wage. But, you know, by 2017, hopefully it is moot that we will have a federal raise to the minimum wage. And certainly $10.10 by 2017, we don't know how much further that's going to fall relative to what the minimum wage was in 1968. But thank goodness for baby steps, I guess. So it's good news. I don't want to discount it too much. But all right, we're going to take a break. A reminder. Tomorrow on this program, we will start our live program at 11:30 a.m. This will not impact you if you listen by a podcast. But tomorrow, we will be live at 11:30 a.m. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Mika Utrecht. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Mika Utrecht. He is the online editor for The Jacobin and author of Strike for America, Chicago Teachers Against Austerity. Thanks for joining us, Mika.
My pleasure.
So, you know, we've talked about the Chicago teachers strike of 2012 on this program to a certain extent, but just take us back to 2012. Tell us what it was that the teachers were striking against. I mean, I guess a broad question, but in just walk us through the sort of the narrative of what happened at that time, what the outcome was, before we sort of delve into the issues you talk about in your book.
So the immediate reason for striking was over contract negotiations that were happening in 2012. But the bigger picture, I think, is the sort of decade or decade and a half of education reform in this country that has been free market education reform. In the recent years, teachers have come under serious attack, have been sort of demonized and held responsible for a lot of the problems of urban education. We've seen things like rise of charter schools, specifically designed to bust teachers' unions and make it so that teachers are not paid as much and have fewer job protections, and a general effort to turn public education, to privatize, turn public education into any other kind of good that's traded on the free market. And so in Chicago, that was the demands for their contract in 2012 were certainly in line with that kind of thinking. I mean, you know, there was a demand from Rahm Emanuel and from the Chicago School Board to introduce things like merit pay, to increase the proportion that a teacher's evaluation would be based on standardized testing. But in general, as I said, the bigger picture is the sense that teachers were under attack, and that that the Chicago teachers would have to go on strike in order to really send a message you know, against those attacks, and to really fight back in the strongest way they could to the strike.
And pay wasn't even I mean, it wasn't even a question of pay as the primary driver of the strike.
Right, the question of pay was settled very early on in negotiations, and even though teachers had been, Rahm Emanuel had demanded that teachers work longer hours for basically the same amount of pay, which you know, amounts to a pay cut essentially. That issue had been settled early on. What was left unresolved was questions about teacher evaluation. But then also this larger question of fighting back against this corporate reform agenda.
So, and the outcome of the strike was fairly positive, let's say, right? I mean, it was, or I should say, just in its narrowest terms, in terms of what ultimately the deal they got, it was fairly positive. There was a sense, at least, that the teachers won the strike.
Yeah, I think that's unquestioned. Everyone, save maybe Rahm Emanuel himself, was publicly saying in the city that teachers had won the strike. And this, despite the fact that there were some very serious, you know, losses that did come out of the strike in their new contract. I mean, the contract that they eventually negotiated was sort of the best they could receive under the conditions they were bargaining under. But it was still recession era contract. It was still an austerity contract, and their leadership was very open about that and said, you know, we've won some things in here, and some things aren't as bad as they could have been if we hadn't gone on strike. But this is still not any kind of perfect document. But the bigger point in the strike and where the real victory lies is in partially defeating this education reform agenda that seemed like it could never be stopped.
Okay, so let's turn to the sort of the broader themes, I think, of your book, and also of why this strike and what led up to it, maybe more so, is it can be instructive both for the labor movement and for the left in general. Let's talk about the sort of the process that took place in the union to bring us up to 2012 that brought this strike about, because it speaks to problems that exist in unions across the country, both within and without teachers' unions. So just sort of walk us through how that strike came about.
Sure. So, I think a lot of people think of the strike as just sort of happening out of thin air, and maybe it was the result of some strong personalities in the teachers union leadership or something that led to the strike. But really, you can't understand the 2012 strike without understanding the decades worth of attempts to reform the Chicago teachers union and fights within the Chicago teachers union about what their union was going to look like that preceded the 2012 strike. So there had grown a pretty conservative and sort of calcified leadership over the decades that had been in charge of the union for the better part of the last four decades. Teachers were growing sort of restless at a time when these attacks were starting to become clearer on teachers, that schools are being closed, that the teachers are being blamed for the new conditions in urban schools. And the union, at the time, the union leadership seemed uninterested in mounting any kind of serious pushback against this agenda. They were sort of enjoying the perks of being, in the leadership position and paying themselves nice, large salaries, but they weren't interested in creating any kind of move to push back against these things.
Let me just stop you here just to, because I mean, you come from the labor movement, so some of this stuff may be, when we say it's grown calcified, we're not just talking about just for people to get a sense of what this dynamic, but there's to the extent that the union leadership was fighting for anything, they were also their relationship to the whole notion of the movement to privatize education and their relationship to sort of the power center and those people in the Democratic Party that they had transactional relationship with. Talk about just how, what it means to calcify in that regard.
So there was everything from the union leadership not being willing to engage with the growing and increasingly vibrant movement in the city to oppose school closures and other, you know, free market reform efforts. You know, there were community groups in neighborhoods of color that were really bearing the brunt of a lot of these policies, who were organizing, you know, scrappy community groups, certainly without huge amounts of resources, but they're mounting this fight against the school closures and corporate education reform. And the union seemingly has no desire to engage with those communities on that fight, despite the fact that, you know, school closures obviously affect teachers as much as they affect community members and students. But, you know, the union has no desire to engage in those fights and is actively attempting to squash, you know, efforts of activist teachers to start those kind of coalitions with community groups. You know, when at this time when there's increasing rhetoric coming from the halls of power in Chicago against Chicago teachers, the union just thinks that the best strategy is to kind of cozy up to those who are in power and sort of appear to be reasonable leaders, the kind of folks that, you know, the mayor and the Board of Education can talk to and the kind of folks they can get along with, right? They think that, that being sort of reasonable and being skilled negotiators is what's going to produce gains for public education and for their teachers. And this is, you know, this is a very common dynamic around the entire American labor movement. I mean, so many unions have grown incredibly bureaucratic, incredibly conservative in, you know, sort of politically, but also in their notions of what's possible and what their task as a union leader is. The leadership in the CTU is sort of emblematic of that large conservative union bureaucracy that exists in a lot of unions around the country.
And they saw their role as specifically sort of very narrowly trying to get the best deal they could for their teachers, right?
I mean, right. They exist to get better benefits and pay for teachers, and that's about it. They don't have any sort of responsibility towards the broader working class, towards creating any kind of big working class movement or movement for educational justice or any of that thing. It's very much kind of bread and butter issues. It's what's, you know, typically referred to as business unionism, that the sort of leadership takes care of the membership by getting them good contracts and good health care and good wages, and then that's about all they do. And then of course the members don't have to really engage much in the union because the union leadership is going to take care of them.
And so then we see during that the decade between 2000 to 2010, the rise of a caucus within the union, called the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, CORE. Tell us about what CORE was doing differently and how they took power in that union.
So it's an interesting history because there is actually a failed reform attempt before CORE comes about in the union in 2001 that is by some folks who consider themselves the sort of liberal reformers. And their main pitch to the union membership is the people who have represented you previously are corrupt, they're inept, but, you know, you should vote for us and then we will take care of you. You know, these folks have done an awful job, but we are competent and we will do a much better job. And there's no desire to have any kind of changed relationship with the 30,000 members of the union. It's just sort of what needs to happen is a replacement of the people on top with people who are more competent and who are better able to serve their membership. And this reform effort failed. It fails to engage the members in any real way, and they can't do any better on the job than the people who they just replaced. And so the old guard returns to power in 2008, 2004. And so there's a small group of activist teachers, some of whom were involved in that reform effort, some of whom weren't, who are sort of taking stock of what's gone on with the union. They've seen that this kind of top-down reform effort hasn't really produced anything that's any different from what the unionism that they had previously experienced. And so this group of teachers, rather than saying we need to find someone to run for office within the union and run them as a candidate, they say, no, we should build up an organization of rank-and-file teachers that has a wide membership within the CTU itself. That really works alongside, as partners and as equals with these community groups and communities of color in the neighborhood who are fighting school closures. They see themselves as forming the kind of broad educational justice movement that their union leadership had refused to create. And so over the years in the mid 2000s, they're slowly, going to hearings, for example, of school closures. And when teachers and parents get up to speak, against the closure, they sort of recruit them to the group that they're creating. They're doing sort of political education stuff. Karen Lewis, the president of the CTU, likes to tell the story of reading Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine. Reading this book is sort of allows them to put what's happened in their school. They realize that it's not an anomaly. That's sort of part of this larger project of trying to privatize the public sphere and to sell off public goods. They're holding community forums on school closures and on things like Renaissance 2010, which is the plan for school reform that the CPS, the Chicago Public Schools CEO, Arnie Duncan, has instituted. And so they're doing all these things. They're holding mass rallies. They're doing all these things that the union should have been doing, but had adamantly refused to do for a long time. And they were just a sort of group of, ragtag teachers who had no kind of budget or any real resources. But just the small group of teachers is able to create an organization of teachers alongside community groups that is eventually able to win leadership in the union.
Now, when they set out, because this is sort of counterintuitive, right? Did they set out to gain the leadership of the union? Because it's a little bit counterintuitive to say we're going to build our power within the context of this union by actually going outside of the union and developing right. a coalition with other groups that our current union doesn't necessarily, maybe is simpatico, but is in no way sort of actively fighting for that that agenda. So they enter into that process sort of thinking like, this is a strategy to get leadership, or is it just this is a holistic strategy that will include taking over the leadership?
The way that it was described to me in interviews I did for the book was that this folks, these teachers really didn't have any intention of taking over the union, at least in the beginning, and didn't think of themselves as people. Unions are huge bureaucracies that are really difficult to run. They've got millions of dollars in the budget and in charge of billions of dollars in pension funds and things like that. And so it's a scary thing to figure out how to run. I don't think any of the early activists had much of an inkling that they were going to eventually take over the union. It was their hope that they could serve as a body that would push their union leadership to the left, that they would be this kind of activist force that could be agitating within the union. And it actually wasn't until people from the community groups that they were working alongside encouraged them to run for the union office that they decided to run in 2010. They had successes in the organizing that they had done alongside these community groups. In, for example, getting some schools off of the school closure list that the city was every year was closing 5 or 6 or 7 different schools. And for the first time, once CORE was organizing alongside these community groups, they were able to get some of those closures off of the closure list. And the community members say to the teachers, well, look at what we've been able to accomplish here just as this group of folks who were organizing after school, on our own dime. Imagine what we could accomplish if you ran for your union leadership and took it over and really that whole institution and all of its resources behind this kind of organizing that we've created. And so, it was an explicit recognition, I think, on those early activists' part that the way to create a strong union that could actually fight back against these attacks that the teachers and the communities of color in Chicago have been experiencing is through reaching out beyond just the other union members, but to really create a movement that involves a broad swath of the city of Chicago.
So yeah, the idea was we're doing this more just to build our social capital. As opposed to sort of and use that as a leverage, almost sort of parallel to the union, to what the union is doing, and that attracted. I mean, how close was the vote in 2010? In other words, by that point, after sort of building this broader social capital, had they attracted enough support from a union membership that this was sort of a slam dunk at that point?
I'm not sure it was a slam dunk, but they did, they won in 2010. There was within the union, there's a number of different caucuses that exist, and they didn't win the vote outright, but they forced a runoff and had convinced other caucuses that were running for leadership in the union to vote as a block with them in the second round of running. And I believe in the second round of running, it wasn't really that close, something like 60 to 40%. To jump ahead a little bit, the union leadership was up for re-election last year, obviously after the strike had happened, and they won with nearly 80% of the vote. Mm. So there's clearly this sort of mandate from the 26,000 to 27,000 members of the union that they believe in the kind of unionism that has emerged under CORE.
And talk also about how, I mean, this was not just the ascension of a caucus within the union that had a different strategy, this sort of build this social movement unionism, I guess, but also it was reflected in a different process of leadership. There was a story you told about, when CORE first got the leadership, they signed off on some legislation that turned out and then reversed themselves. Will you tell that story just to give a sense of how they changed the process within the union?
Right. So if you remember my mentioning of this first reform caucus, this first sort of top-down reform effort, they were very explicit about not wanting to repeat those mistakes. And so it was their intention to create a really strong democratic union that was led by its rank and file members. And they wanted to do that not simply because, democracy is this good thing in the abstract, but that they realized that if they were going to be able to win on, and if they were going to be able to go on strike and they were going to be able to accomplish anything as a union, they would have to have the buy-in and the involvement of a huge part of their membership, of all, 26,000 people within the union. And so that's part of their pitch in running for office is not, we are more competent and we are, smarter leaders than the people we're replacing, but we are going to put you, the rank and file teacher, the average teacher in the classroom, we're going to be asking you to take real responsibility for this union and get involved with it in new ways and really run it yourself. And then you are going to be the ones who make the decisions about this. This is really strong emphasis on creating a kind of democracy within the union and creating structures that engage teachers who, frankly, had never been engaged with that way before. And so this comes out in 2011 when there's a state bill called SB7 that is introduced at the behest of a corporate education reform group. It's called Stand for Children.
Who wouldn't want to stand with children? Who would not
exactly,
want to stand
right,
with children?
That's the question. That's the question that they want you to ask, right? This bill accomplishes a number of things. It would make it basically impossible for teachers to strike. It would limit the scope of what teachers could bargain over. You know, when teachers are, or excuse me, what they could bargain over, like, what they could go on strike over within bargaining. So, if, you know, if a teacher, a teacher's union is going on strike over, you know, smaller class sizes, for example, that's a pretty good PR, you know, thing for that union. And the district looks like they're being villains if they're refusing to, if they're aiming to, you know, increase the size of classrooms in schools. But if the teachers are only able to go on strike over wages and benefits, then it's a sort of easy way to paint these teachers as striking because they're sort of greedy, lazy, mm-hmm. public, blah, blah, blah. So that's part of this bill. It narrows the scope of what the teachers can bargain and strike over. But there's also this provision that's designed to make it so teachers can't go on strike. And the core, the caucus, is just a few months out of the classroom at this point, right? You know, again, no, very little experience in running this massive bureaucracy that is a union. And they sort of get, the leadership goes down to Springfield, the state capital, to negotiate this bill and to get their name down to it, basically, and be involved in the negotiations over it. And the leadership is inexperienced at this point. Only a few of them down there, and they sign off on what is really a pretty odious bill that would have succeeded in probably making it totally impossible for any teachers to go on strike, for the Chicago teachers to go on strike. And so the leadership brings this bill back to the members, and it's a time, you remember, right when these folks are elected, you know, the old guard is sort of waiting in the wings, ready to pounce on anybody who, you know, on these new inexperienced young radicals, and they'd certainly be waiting to say, look, you know, look, these people, they get in the office just a few months and they've already, you know, totally defanged us as a union and signed off on our ability to strike. And so, there's this sort of delicate moment where the caucus could have really been in some trouble. And it would have been easy, I think, for the people who were the members of CORE, to sort of double down behind their leadership and support them, even though they had just taken what was clearly a really wrong-headed step. And it's a unique thing about the caucus and about the union leadership in the CTU that they actually are able to sort of have a back and forth, and you know, the leadership is able to admit, after being called out by their caucus members, the people who just got them elected to office, that they were, what they did was really wrong, and that they need to go back to Springfield, sort of hat in hand, and say that they can't, they need to redact their support for the bill and renegotiate some of the more odious parts of it. And so it's a unique moment because you know, it's core members themselves who are the ones who introduce on the floor of the union's House of Delegates, their governing body, this resolution, sort of calling out their leadership and saying that this bill is horrible and that you need to renegotiate it and whatever. And so there's this level of independence between the caucus and their people in office, in power in the union. And the caucus provides this sort of independent check, even on their own people who are in office.
Is that a function of the personalities? In other words, you know, it is just far more typical for someone who has just obtained power or who is in power to double down on that, and for the people who are part of that same caucus to double down on their support, because this is my conduit to the leadership. I'm not going to sacrifice that. I mean, in some ways, that dynamic is analogous to the dynamic of a union approaching a Democratic mayor, let's say, or a Democratic governor, wherein, you know, I need to manage this relationship and I don't want to screw the pooch on it. Or was there something that the CORE, once it became in leadership, instituted in terms of a process that made that outcome more likely that they would reverse themselves?
I think that certainly the personality, individual personality piece is important and shouldn't be played down. I mean, it is a really difficult thing for anyone, no matter what their political background is, to admit that they've made a huge mistake like that and you know, sort of submit to being called out on the carpet. But I think the bigger issue is the sort of the political analysis of the folks in the caucus and their recognition that, unlike the previous reform effort, what was needed in the union was not just replacing the people who are in power, but, you know, recognizing that no matter who's in power, there's still this temptation there's still the possibility that you can sort of succumb to what are really sort of conservatizing and sort of bureaucratic impulses within the union, that anyone, no matter what their politics are, who is in charge of a massive institution like a union, can succumb to, and they can sort of go down that sort of more bureaucratic and conservative type of path of unionism. And so there was a recognition from the beginning that is a dynamic that is not specific to any one kind of personality or any political persuasion, that no matter who's in office, that dynamic exists. And so you need an independent body that exists that can provide a check on whoever is in.
And did they create an institutional mechanism for that? I mean, in other words, did they change the structure of the union in any way that allowed for that independence, check?
Well, it was partially a function of the fact that this group had grown so large that they had engaged and trained and developed a new layer of leadership within the union. Of the rank and file membership who felt comfortable, you know, calling out their leaders like this. But they also, I mean, after this incident happened, there was sort of attempts to create new sort of firewalls maybe between the people who were in the office of the union, who were the official sort of paid staff, and the rank and file folks of the caucus. So they sort of have the former leadership step down from the steering committee, the executive board of the caucus, for example. And so, yeah, they take some steps that make it so that there is a level of independence, a level of formal independence, which is, you know, it sounds sort of wonky and insider baseballish, but if you think about that's a really difficult thing to figure out how to, institutionalize in your union, and these people who you trust in and who you worked your butt off to get elected, you still feel like you need to have some kind of, and they're your friends, assumedly, right?
Right.
But you still realize that you need to have a check on them. That's a very difficult thing to figure out how to do, and there have been a lot of caucuses and similar reform attempts in the past in the American labor movement that have won office and been successful, and then have very quickly gone down in flames, in part because they haven't had that level of accountability and check on their leadership, with the folks that they just got elected to the union.
Right, and that's why, ultimately the value of this story is what lessons can be taken by other unions, and it seems to me that the big takeaways from what happened in Chicago were A, this need to create a social movement that is broader than servicing your own union members. It's obviously easier, right, to do this with teachers, because teachers teachers are the only, I think, sort of, I can think of in terms of like of public workers, let's say, that or even private union workers that have the people they want to do outreach to, the first line of people, are actually people who are trying to contact them on a daily basis to find out what's going on with their kids. So they have that built-in sort of communication network that is, you don't need to build that as much as take advantage of that and broaden it. But that's a big, I think, takeaway from the strike, is that there needs to be a move by union members and by union leadership to bridge to share the agenda of other coalitions that are sort of pushing in the same direction as they are.
Right. I think it's it's easiest and most natural for teachers' unions to make that leap, but it's certainly possible for many other public sector unions to do similar kinds of unionism. We've seen a bit of that in healthcare unions, for example, and nurses unions that are not just making their campaigns and contract negotiations about their wages and benefits, but want good patient to nurse ratios so that they can give patients the proper attention that they deserve. And they've made their bargaining about the sort of collective bargaining for the common good rather than just for their own narrow interests. But certainly the lessons are most easily applicable to other teachers' unions who, as you said, have this sort of built-in infrastructure that already exists that can be taken advantage of. It's difficult to see how, a steel worker or a hotel worker could, find common cause with the people using the steel or the people staying in their hotels.
But that doesn't mean that they can't find, that just means that they need to, the cause must be not so much necessarily from their customers as it is from other people who are sort of like engaged in similar struggles, right?
It's true. And if you think, there's historical precedent for this, certainly. In 1997, the Teamsters under a reform leadership went on strike at UPS. And that strike was a strike that was in part about part-time hours and the increasing number of jobs in America that weren't where bosses were refusing to give workers sort of full-time hours. And so it's certainly possible even in the private sector to make those kinds of to make labor campaigns about issues that are confronting the country more generally, not just their own bread and butter issues.
All right, we don't have too much time left, but I want to touch on the dynamic that unions have to make a choice about in terms of the way they relate to the Democratic Party, and also speak to your perspective on what on those lessons for the left in general. I mean, because unions have this very difficult situation where they just take, for instance, in New York State, you have to maintain a transactional relationship with Governor Cuomo, who ran right. explicitly on trying to quash unions in some way. And the idea of whether or not you want to go outside of a certain system or reform within. I mean, just talk about those issues, as it relates to what happened in Chicago.
Sure. So there's two things there. I mean, on the one hand, there's a long history, contemporary history, and long history of unions just sort of forking over endless amounts of cash to the Democratic Party, even at a time when the Democratic Party doesn't even pretend to want to placate labor as a constituency, right? And so there's this is a dynamic that's existed for quite a long time, and there are occasional grumblings on the left, on the left flank of the American labor movement, who's saying, we're not getting anything out of this relationship. The Democratic Party continues to be screwing us, and we need this kind of clean break tomorrow, today, with the Democratic Party. No more interactions with them whatsoever. We need to build towards a kind of third party, workers' party or a working class party or some kind of independent political formation, right? Both of those strategies are really not feasible in the long run or even in the short run. I mean, the latter is not feasible because, as you said, unions have no choice but to play ball, even with some of these people who they find particularly odious. I mean, and in that bill, I should say, that we were discussing before, SB 7, that led to, almost made it impossible for the CTU to go on strike, that bill was passed at a time when the union had withdrawn the support of a lot of state-level Democrats because they were angry with these Democrats on a pension bill that they had passed. And so these corporate reform groups saw this opportunity for them to swoop in and provide the kind of financial support that the CTU had just pulled from these Democrats, and that's what allows them to get this odious corporate education reform bill passed. So, or things like, if you look at like pensions, there's a very real day that the Chicago Teachers Union members and retirees could have their pensions eviscerated. And if they don't interact with the Democratic Party in Springfield on these issues. They might feel good about their sort of moral and political purity, but they're going to be left high and dry without pension. So clearly there is a need to engage with the Democratic Party on sort of day-to-day political issues. But on the other hand, the unions have not engaged in any kind of sort of combative relationship with the Democrats. They've continued to give over so many resources and have not expected or demanded anything in return. And that is not a tenable situation. I think, education in particular shows why that's not tenable. I mean, teachers' unions continue to give huge amounts of money to the Democratic Party, while they've got, President Obama, his Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, is putting forward, a race to the top that is extremely detrimental to public education and the teachers' unions. So unless the labor movement can figure out a way to engage in a more combative way with the Democratic Party and really, confront the right flank of the party, the party is going to continue just sort of drifting off towards the right and towards, embracing these measures that are dismantling public education. And so I think the CTU has sort of shown a way for, labor unions to continue to engage where it's required with the Democratic Party, but also indicated a willingness to take on, the right flank and people like Rahm Emanuel. And even, we don't have much time left, but there's an independent political organization that the union has recently created that, among other things, has indicated that if credible, independent third-party candidates emerge in, city council races or state representative races, that they might be willing to back them. They're playing a sort of delicate dance between engaging with people who they find certainly aren't their friends on the Democratic Party, but they're also sort of blazing a new trail, I think, figuring out how to build an alternative.
So there's a carrot and stick in this situation, right? I mean, that's basically what it comes down to, and that stick, you can only really get that stick if you are broadening, I guess, the base of the people you're sharing in that movement.
Right.
All right. Well, Micah Utrich, the book is Teachers Strike for America: Chicago Teachers Versus Austerity. We will put a link to that book at majority.fm. And, of course, folks should be checking out the Jacobin at jacobin.org?
JacobinMag.com.
JacobinMag.com. We will put a link to that as well. Thanks so much for your time today, Micah.
Thanks, Harvey.
All right, folks. Perfect timing for the phone system to collapse. We're going to take a break. Head into the funner half of the program, wherein it's the classic lament, folks, of not being able to stone gays anymore, that we will hear from our good friend Pat Robertson. We will also listen to President Obama, I believe, maybe we have some sound of that, speaking in Brussels, trying to defend the Iraq invasion. I don't know. Maybe I'll wait to talk to Cliff about that, because it is so stunning, I think, and so indicative of sort of this sort of dynamic of sort of original sin with this administration in many respects. Because it's so hard for him to distance himself. And we will talk about that in the funner half of the program, because that stuff couldn't be funner. Folks, your support makes this show possible. And you can support this program by becoming a member. Your 33 cents a day will not only pay for the 40, sometimes 50 minutes of free content that you get a day. I mean, I guess technically it's not free if you're paying less than one penny per minute every day. But as a bonus, we give you an extra 50 minutes. So you do the math, because I can't possibly do it exactly what you'd be paying on a per minute basis at that point. Very little, I think, is a fraction of a penny per minute. Where else can you get that type of value except for on the Majority Report? And you can also support this program if you buy crap from Amazon. If that is what you do, why not at least have a small percentage of that get kicked back to your favorite political radio program or podcast, The Majority Report, by going to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, the Amazon link, bookmark it. Whenever you buy your crap from Amazon, if you buy crap from Amazon, simply use that link. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. And if we can figure out any other kickback schemes, we will. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. All right, we're going to take a break. Head into the fun half, wherein we will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will also take your IMs. We will be back in a moment. Just a reminder, tomorrow we are live at 11:30 a.m.